Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
New York Times chief Washington correspondent and WNYC contributor David Sanger is our first guest today. At a moment of new intensity for the United States in the Middle East, and as I said before the news, this is not just about Syria, but also the closing, prosecuting of 19 Americans who work for pro-democracy groups in Egypt, new Obama sanctions against Iran, and a Palestinian unity government between Hamas and Fatah that will offer new challenges for Washington. So hi, David, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Brian.
I guess the breaking news from Syria is that the Russian foreign minister reports that President Assad told him he would be open to dialogue with the opposition. Does that mean anything at all?
You know, it's really hard to say, because when the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, left, he gave absolutely no details of what that meant. And, of course, when the Arab League was in over the past 2 weeks before they had to withdraw because the fighting was so heavy, we saw a lot of things that the Syrian government said to them, including that there were no attacks underway that were patently untrue. So it's not clear if this is something he said because he thought Mr. Lavrov was trying to cast himself in a different light, having voted against the sanctions in the United Nations, or just something that he thought the world wanted to hear, or whether there's really going to be some kind of conversation that will take place.
We talked on the show yesterday about Russia vetoing the UN Security Council resolution that would have called for President Assad to step down and stop the ongoing violence against dissidents and rebels. Secretary of State Clinton and the Arab League said they would look for other means of stopping Assad, especially with what's becoming a humanitarian crisis there. Has anything emerged in the last day as an alternative?
Nothing I've seen that's very impressive, Brian. I mean, let's look at the various options. There are some economic sanctions that you could do, but first of all, it's a pretty permeable border, and secondly, most of those sanctions are likely to make life worse for a population that's already been displaced from their homes or have been subject to random killing. So people don't want to make life miserable for ordinary Syrians. The military options seem enormously complex. This isn't Libya. It doesn't have access from the sea. It doesn't have the troops out in the desert where they could easily be attacked from the air. Much of this fighting is happening in the cities. It's unclear who's on what side. So it's a mess from a military viewpoint. And the major diplomacy, one would think, would be with the Arab League. Those are the people with most of the juice with the Syrian government. And so far, their efforts have been either a failure or completely divided.
So listeners, maybe you've been listening to the BBC special on Syria that ran last hour, or want to weigh in any case on this situation that is reaching a diplomatic head and a military head in Syria. 212-433-WNYC. Questions or comments for David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. 212-433-WNYC. Or post to our website, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show for the page for this segment. And you can also bring up some of the other things challenging the United States in the Middle East right now. Egypt announcing that it will prosecute 19 Americans who work for non-governmental organizations there, including the son of the Transportation Secretary, Ray LaHood, and anyone else. 212-433-WNYC. If you want to get in on that, or I should say anything else from the Middle East, the Fatah-Hamas unity government announcement or the new Obama sanctions against Iran. Remind us, David, Russia's main interest in protecting Syria is what? Is it just arms sales?
Well, there is a big arms sales element. There's an element of keeping a fair bit of influence in the Middle East, where you have seen many of the Arab states really team up with the United States because of their fear of an Iranian nuclear program. But, you know, Brian, I can't help but think that there was something a little bit deeper going on here. I mean, you had Russia and China as the only two major powers that were voting against this resolution in the Security Council. They're both countries that have seen, to various degrees, very mild Arab Spring-like protests, these protests on the streets against Putin coming back. The Chinese have cracked down on almost any form of protest, but there have been a few that have been attempted. And I have to think that they are trying to walk back whatever precedent was set during the Libya resolution earlier in the year, which pretty well established that the Security Council felt it could go in and establish a responsibility to protect people who are being abused by their own governments. And what Russia and China are saying here is, no, old borders count, and the UN's authority stops at a country's border. That is a big step back from where the United Nations was headed, particularly under the concept that there is a responsibility to protect those who are being abused.
And ironically, I think that concept really came to prominence after the end of the Cold War, when the Balkans started to crack up and people started to debate, does the United Nations have an affirmative responsibility to actually move in? And, you know, there was even talk at that time of a standing UN army, do you remember that, to carry out the responsibility to protect.
It was also born from a failure, Brian. It was born from the failure in Rwanda. And so, you know, the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton said that one of his biggest regrets was getting Rwanda wrong. He then went off and did the Balkans, got that much more right, and those were the negotiations that were led by Richard Holbrooke. And it was that memory that really drove many in the Obama administration when they were making the decisions about Libya. In fact, Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice, the American ambassador to the United Nations, were all very clear that it was Rwanda that was in the backs of their minds. So now comes Syria, and the excuse that the Russians and the Chinese used, and it's somewhat understandable, is that the Libya mission turned from a mission to protect to become a regime change mission. And they're playing a game of payback.
Ken in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ken.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. One of the things that has struck me about this conflict in Syria right now is the change geopolitically, from, you know, Syria being a Russian client and still sort of is, and Israel being an American client and they still sort of are, but now this is a chance. I was hoping for Russia and America to work, positively together, for at least one incremental step toward peace. And I'm wondering, do the Russians think that they can really keep Assad in power in Syria, or why are they not working for a peaceful transition?
Great question. David?
It is a great question, because my own view right now is that while Assad may survive this period of the next few months, I think he is so mortally wounded by what has happened here that he can't last for that much longer. And so the question becomes one that's similar to the one we asked in Egypt during the fairly quick transition with Mubarak, which is, how many people do you want to see die at the hands of security forces while they're holding off a transition that we all think is likely to happen anyway? And that would have been the best argument in favor of the UN resolution. It was the best argument that the Arab League, that the United States, that many of the other allies, everyone really except Russia and China, believed that this transition was going to happen anyway, so it would be most peaceful to have it happen quickly.
And then if it happens
I can't
anyway,
figure out the Russian game right now to hold on.
Then Russia would look bad. And in fact, Russia suddenly has street protests of its own. You mentioned this. Wasn't there a big one on Saturday, the very day Russia was vetoing the UN resolution?
There was. It would be impossible to prove that these two events are completely related, but it would be impossible to believe that they are unrelated.
And who is protesting in Russia, and what do they want?
Well, those who are protesting in Russia, I think, are mostly concerned about the movement by Putin to basically figure out a way around the Constitution and become the country's leader for life, even if he isn't president for life. So he had his terms. He then put Medvedev in place. Medvedev has said recently that there was an agreement that goes back some time in which Putin would then come out and succeed Medvedev again. And, you know, I'm sure there are those in Russian society who probably find this not at all disturbing. But it certainly looks like a way to route around the term limits that are built into the Russian Constitution.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. And by the way, the Times editorial board today comes out against arming the Syrian rebels, fearing that might just get more people killed. Rather, it's for isolating Syria in hopes that Assad will lose support of the army and the business elite. So do you think there's evidence that one or the other might protect more people? And I guess we should just, for the record, make the distinction that you're a reporter for The Times, not a member of the editorial board. You did not take that position.
Right.
But it frames one of the two positions out there, and I'm sure it's a very difficult internal debate for Secretary of State Clinton and her colleagues around the world as to whether that's actually in the interest of the Syrian people to arm the rebels or allow the rebels to be armed on the underground market.
You know, it's a really hard call, and right now the rebels seem to have very little of the firepower. In fact, most of it they've gotten, or much of it that they've gotten from defectors from the Syrian military. But if you arm the rebels, you're off into a full-scale civil war. We're probably pretty close to that anyway. What worries me is that sanctioning Syria, first of all, takes time. Secondly, hurts the people you're trying to help. And thirdly, may not be all that effective. I mean, think of the kind of sanctions that we have had as a country against North Korea or Cuba or Iran over these many years. And the record seems to show that they're not a great way of making governments make decisions that they believe will affect their actual survivability. They might affect behavior around the edges, but not. They don't go to questions of regime survival. And Iran is probably the number one example here, where Iran has put up with huge sanctions that in recent weeks and months have gotten far worse. And yet there's no indication that the central issue on the table, which is their nuclear program, has been affected in the least.
And Iraq is another good example. All those years between the first Iraq war and the second one, when the U.S. had sanctions in place that were supposed to isolate Saddam Hussein and weaken him, he strengthened his grip on power, and there became a worldwide protest movement against the United States because babies were dying as the result of the sanctions, they said, and other economic things that just squeeze the people without so much affecting the regime.
Right.
So,
now, there are moments where sanctions can work. South Africa was an interesting example. But the literature on this is huge. But usually to make sanctions work, first of all, everyone's got to be in on it. And clearly the Russians and the Chinese wouldn't be here. And secondly, to make sanctions work, you have to be doing something that trying to get something from the regime that's less than regime suicide. And let's face it, regime suicide is what the world is asking for right now in the case of Syria.
South Africa also had an incredible amount of people power behind it, not just government-imposed sanctions, but a worldwide movement on behalf of ending apartheid. And I think it was a different kind of pressure that came to bear over time. Jay in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jay.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I'm just curious why the U.S. is always bothering Iran, like trying to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons. I mean, they haven't did anything militarily against the U.S. at all. And, I mean, no country would use a nuclear weapon in this day and age, seeing what happened to Japan, because if they will look like the most evil country out there, and people will end up destroying them if they use one. So I don't see what the big deal is. It's like the U.S. is prodding and poking with them so that they could, you know, do something to the U.S. so we could go to war. I'm just trying to figure that out. You know, I don't know if you guys could explain, you know, what's the reasoning behind it.
Well, David, it is a good question. It's a question that Ron Paul would ask. And it's a question that I would ask with respect to the prospect that any country would actually use nuclear weapons. It would be mutually assured destruction, as they say. In fact, it would be suicide on the part of the Iranian government if they were ever to use a nuclear weapon against Israel or any other country, because the rest of the world would come get them. Talk about regime change.
Sure. And if you think about the classic concept from the Cold War of how people use nuclear weapons, your caller's absolutely right. Brian, you're absolutely right. And I think the issue that people are least worried about with Iran is a nuclear weapon that you screw on top of a missile and, you know, shoot at Israel or American forces in the Middle East, or if they ever got the range, shoot it at Europe or the United States. However, we don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world where nuclear weapons bring you two other forms of power that you have to be much more concerned about. The first is slipping a weapon to a terrorist. And since Iran is one of the world's chief sponsors of terrorism, mostly through Hamas and Hezbollah, the possibility that terrorists could ultimately get either a weapon or a material has got to be a concern. Now, you can argue that the science of tracking that back has been pretty good, and that the Iranians know that they wouldn't get away with it. It's all a question of what level of risk you want to take there. The second is that getting a nuclear weapon gives you a degree of immunity and power within the region. And frankly, I don't think the Iranians have any intention of using a nuclear weapon. However, I think they may well want to become the largest regional power in the area again. And then the third issue, of course, is that as soon as Iran gets one, you've created the conditions for an arms race in the Middle East, one that remarkably didn't happen after Israel got its nuclear weapons. But I think other Arab states, particularly the Sunni states, have made it pretty clear they're going to go for a weapon if Iran gets one.
John in Stamford, you're on WNYC. Hello, John.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning, Mr. Sanger. I want to raise two points. One is the obvious hypocrisy in the United States government approach towards Yemen and towards Syria. On the one hand, we're allowing Mr. Saleh to come into the United States for quote-unquote medical treatment, and let's bring up the Shah of Iran, who came here in 1980 and was the guest of the United States at Lackland Air Force Base for apparently medical treatment that could be obtained no other place. And we'll remember Bruce Langen, the chargé d'affaires in Iran, who put embassy takeover as the fourth conundrum on his list if the Shah was allowed into the United States. So on the one hand, we let this man in for medical treatment.
1979, just to be precise, before that November embassy siege, yes.
That's correct. And we'll remember the suit between David Rockefeller's personal doctor, Dr. Benjamin Keene, an expert on tropical diseases, who was sent to Egypt to diagnose pancreatic cancer. And yet the State Department, with the help of Mr. Rockefeller and Mr. Kissinger, pressed the U.S. government to let him in. He came in, and we had the results. Now
so your point for today is allowing Saleh in for medical treatment here after he slaughtered some of his own people in Yemen while going after Assad?
Well, that's correct. We're allowing Mr. Saleh to slaughter his own people because we view Yemen as a vital vital area for our transgressions with, you know, whoever it is in the Middle East that we have a disagreement with. It is the sluice gate for the Red Sea. We all know that. But the point is, you can't have a policy that gets respected around the world, especially not in the Arab street, where you vilify one leader for taking actions which, while repugnant, are security actions, and in the same policy have Saleh taking actions which are, again, security actions, killing many, many hundreds of his own people.
John, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. And it is true that the U.S. relies on the government of Yemen to fight al-Qaeda in Yemen. That's one of the strongest outposts of al-Qaeda right now, where Awlaki was and some of his allies. But what about the equivalency between Saleh and Assad? David, do you accept it?
Well, I think it's a complex equivalency because while Saleh has had many, many transgressions, it does not strike me that he's done anything on the scale in which Assad has done here. But I think your underlying point is an absolutely correct one, that the United States has, throughout the Arab Spring, as it has in other uprisings, been caught in this argument between our values and our interests. And so in places where it seemed to be less strategically important, values could reign high. And Libya was a classic example. We didn't have many national interests there. And supporting the revolution against a longtime American adversary was fairly easy. But where are the places where it's been difficult for the U.S.? Well, one of them is certainly Yemen. I would say that the bigger case has been Bahrain, where the Fifth Fleet is located, absolutely critical to the American effort to stand up to Iran and keep the Gulf open. And the U.S. has gone very easy on the royal family in Bahrain, despite the fact that at many points they have turned on their own people as well. Not quite on the scale of what we've seen in Syria, but pretty brutally.
David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I do want to touch a couple of these other stories. One is Egypt saying that 19 Americans who work for NGOs, nonprofit groups, will be ordered to stand trial. What's really happening there?
Well, I just came back from Egypt just a few weeks ago, Brian, and I have to tell you, I'm surprised at how this one is proceeding, because President Obama made it pretty clear to General Tantawi, who was running the interim government, that this issue should be pretty well resolved, and if it wasn't resolved, that the funding that Egypt gets from the United States and the U.S. Congress, including the military funding of $1.3 billion, could well be. And so I think there is a significant reason right now to question whether or not Congress is going to provide much of that aid. The military government seems to be trying to appeal to a longtime Egyptian suspicion of these NGOs, that they are not in simply teaching democratic practices, but that they're putting their finger on the scales. But when you think about who it is that they've said that they would like to put under arrest and put on trial here, they're both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, they're people whose interests would not seem to necessarily line up, at least in our world. My guess is that the Egyptians have dug themselves a pretty big hole that they're going to have to spend the next few weeks digging their way out of.
And lastly, the Palestinian leadership announcing a unity government. This is Fatah and Hamas, Fatah in the West Bank, the more militant Hamas, which runs Gaza, and that they will have parliamentary and presidential elections. Now, people will remember during the Bush administration, the Palestinians held their first elections with U.S. support, but Hamas won in Gaza, Fatah won in the West Bank. The Hamas election was a shock to many people. And the U.S. denounced the election and didn't recognize the Gaza government because Hamas is on the terrorism list. And so the other thing about that is that then they didn't hold any more elections until now. They got elected and they just took power. So why is Hamas, why is Fatah coming together at this time, and why are they announcing elections at this time?
Well, the fracturing between Fatah and Hamas was so deep and so bitter that I think they recognized that they were getting in their own way of their own objectives of putting together a state, a point on which obviously they've got wildly different strategic approaches to doing that. Whether this simply papers over those differences in order to try to get back the legitimacy that would come with an election or not is something we'll have to see. But I have a hard time believing that this unity is going to stay together for all that long. Now, of course, the split has given Israel a very convenient excuse not to get negotiations going, because they've said, who do you negotiate with? And in some ways, the unity government poses a bigger problem for the U.S. and for Israel, because whether it's in name only or not, it does now create a single unified entity with whom somebody's going to have to start negotiations.
And if the U.S. position, the Israeli position, is we don't negotiate with terrorists whose charter is bent on the destruction of the country that they're supposedly negotiating with, then you can't negotiate with Fatah either, because they're in a unity government with Hamas.
Yeah, the U.S. government has not quite gone and done the set of math that you just did, although it would seem logical. It does strike me, though, that President Obama realizes that this was probably the biggest foreign policy failure of his time in his first term, that they never quite got it together right on getting talks going again. And my guess is it's going to be very difficult to do that between now and the election, in part because President Obama has got to go repair his relationship with the American Jewish community, and in part because Iran is going to be the overwhelming dominating issue, I think, between now and the election on the foreign policy front.
David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, contributor to WNYC and our sister station WQXR. David, a lot to watch in the Middle East right now and between Washington and the Middle East. Thank you for explaining it, much of it to us.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer proposes new tax rates for New York City. Stay with us.